Every Christmas, I like to watch some Christmas classics, and this year is no different. Except this year, I'm considering urgent care CPD opportunities that I notice whilst watching these films. Today's podcast features a bona fide modern classic that tells the story of an orphan who grew up amongst elves at the North Pole, returning to New York to find his father. The film is Elf, and despite watching it many, many times, it never ceases being charming, funny, and magical. But what can the adventures of a cotton-headed ninny muggins in the Big Apple teach us about urgent care? Well, there is one scene that I recognised as containing an urgent care pearl, and it takes place on Buddy the Elf's journey from the North Pole to New York, which I reckon puts him somewhere in the Canadian wilderness. So, to talk about this scene, and Christmas in general, I'm going to call upon our very own Canadian wilderness medicine expert, Dr. Dinesh Dionarain.
Hello, this is Dinesh speaking.
Dinesh, it's Guy Melrose here. How are you?
Oh, good. Hey, how you going, Guy?
I'm good. It's that time of the year again, Christmas, and I've been just sort of pondering whilst watching my favourite Christmas movies and thinking about urgent care, and I just fancied chatting to a fellow urgent care physician about Christmas and urgent care and films. So I thought if you've got a few moments, would you be able to indulge my my flight of fancy for a moment?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Big fan of Christmas and holidays and whatnot. So yeah. Let's go for it.
My first question to you is basically, are you working at Christmas? And if not, when you do work at Christmas, what do you feel working in an urgent care or an emergency department is like at Christmas?
I do work clinically over Christmas. And you do feel this sort of kind of rising tide of patient flow as you approach the big day and over the holiday season in general. And it is busy. There's no question about it. And I think very much like people's approach to Christmas, I think the key to it is, like, you know, you pace yourself, because if you get really excited on the day that you put up the tree, then you don't really have enough sustainable, probably, dopamine to last all the way to the 25th. So you might be cortisol depleted, dopamine depleted by the time you reach the big day. So you got to kind of pace yourself. And I think that applies to your work clinically. I also sort of dislike it for the same reason, because the busyness is there. But I've often long held the belief that, you know, it's kind of good to be busy. It challenges you. And if you don't do things that are difficult, then how will you ever be able to do things that are difficult? It's one of those kind of fun paradoxes, I find.
And specifically on Christmas Day itself, I've always found that there's a little bit of a lull because everybody's busy doing other things. And if you are in work that day, everybody has a slightly different mood that day. They're all aware that you're working when other people should be with their families, and they bring in food and other and patients. So that little bit, there's just that slight edge off it. And then in the afternoon, that's when people start coming in with excess related things or Christmas present related injuries and things sort of pick up. But that first morning is often just that little bit of a lull before the storm. Do you find that when you've worked a Christmas day?
Yeah. I think that's a fair summary of how things usually roll out over Christmas. And you do get very kind of seasonal related presentations throughout.
Yeah, it's a different holiday as well, isn't it? It's different to other public holidays throughout the year. I quite enjoy that morning, that Christmas morning, but then as the period after Christmas before New Year builds up, I tend to lose my interest. And then obviously New Year, there's a lot more alcohol related things, so I tend to have lost my enjoyment of working at that period of the time by then.
The shine's come off, yeah, it, so to speak, has, yeah, it?
And obviously, you don't need a degree in geography to be able to tell that your accent is very much from the Northern Hemisphere, and you grew up in Canada. And I imagine Canadian Christmases are quite cold. Certainly, English Christmases are very cold and dark. They get you know, the sun's down by 4 o'clock, and very different to what we're experiencing here in New Zealand. So how do you find hot and cold Christmases? Do you have a preference? And if so, why?
Yeah, so that's interesting. That's sort of a great debate. That's a bit of a Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere kind of debate. And I mean, I think I would have to, first of all, admit that there is a certain charm to both. So, you know, with a cold Christmas, it is atmospheric. It is probably what comes to mind when most people think of Christmas. So to kind of live in that environment and experience that, can be very magical. Having said that, I think there is a real charm to a sunny, warm Christmas. I mean, that's something that was kind of quite new to me coming to New Zealand. And it made me think of my first Christmas in New Zealand. I was actually staying and living at a backpacker's in Raglan and spending most of my time surfing and occasionally working. And, you know, we kind of organized ourselves into a loose kind of family unit for Christmas at the backpackers. There's probably a good 30, 40 people there. And we kind of celebrated Christmas. And we thought it would be a great idea to kind of wear costumes, you know, and then go surfing, of course, as you do. So we had a full complement of, you know, elves and Santa and reindeers and Mrs. Claus. And I was Rudolph. And so I distinctly remember having a Rudolph suit over my wetsuit and paddling out. And the first few waves were great, you know, and I was, you know, feeling pretty good in the reindeer suit. So I decided to paddle a little bit, you know, deeper. And I caught a couple waves out there and then had a spectacular wipeout. And I didn't realize how much heavier you were when you're wearing a reindeer suit, which is then saturated. And I remember one of my thoughts, actually, as I was being tossed through the breakers, is that, wow, I'm going to die in New Zealand dressed as a giant soaking wet reindeer. So I don't know. So
I mean, if you've got to
let's
go.
Just say that was a bit of an interesting starting point in terms of Christmases in hot weather. It didn't put me off them. I've started to really kind of enjoy them. But I think I would have to put my chips down on a cold Christmas. You can't beat a snowy Christmas. It's a beautiful, white, magical Christmas. It's pretty amazing.
And I think in Canada you get much more reliable snow than we do in the UK. Whilst I've always imagined Christmas as a white Christmas, as they define it, when snow has fallen in a certain part of, I think it's the roof of the meteorological building in London, I think, is when they define it as, yes, it's been a white Christmas, but it's very, I can't remember any Christmas day being snowy. I may be wrong. But yeah, we always imagine it being snowy, but actually it's quite cold and usually wet and miserable and dark. But the atmosphere is there with the Christmas lights and the food and the decorations and everything. So I do tend to fall on the cold Christmas personally, but I find it interesting because it does change the injuries that you see through urgent care and ED, because we've got people out all day in the sun doing outdoor activities, whereas in the UK people are indoors or in Canada keeping away from the cold, and they're much more likely to injure themselves in different ways come Christmas time. Do you have anything a Canadian Christmas in particular that stands out? Is there something unique to Canada in the Christmas periods that you can think of, or is it fairly typical?
I could probably summarize that in like a top three list, and I think it would go snow and snow. Yeah, I think that pretty well covers it. Yeah. And the fact that, like, you know, you can get a permit and then like chop down your own giant Christmas tree, yes, which is quite an experience. So I'd kind of insert that in as an honorable mention as well, too.
So the Canadian Christmas trees make everyone else's Christmas trees look pretty weedy, because you come in with a big chainsaw and, you know, is there a competition as to who's got the biggest?
Well, you know, I'm sure there is. I didn't really get kind of down that track, but there, I'm sure I've come close to herniating a disc before helping with various families and their Christmas trees. So there's a whole probably slew of medical problems that arise from kind of getting your Christmas tree in Canada as well.
And one of the things I like doing at Christmas is watching films. And I like watching films all year round, but I like to revisit films at Christmas time because they definitely help to add to that atmosphere. And I was wondering if you had any films that maybe remind you of home or in ignite some of those sort of Christmas feelings. Do you have any specific films that you can think of?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I do tend to kind of veer towards the classics. And I know in terms of modern classic, I know our colleague Dave Sorrell picked Love Actually, which you know, that does spring to mind as kind of a modern classic. It's got
it's a good
beautiful Christmas themes weaved in throughout. I actually really like The Busted Old School. And you know, like, I don't think I can ever really get tired of It's a Wonderful Life. Mm. I mean, that kind of like exaggerated overacting from Jimmy Stewart is pretty classic. I mean, you gotta love that. And then I'd have to say The Grinch as well, too. The animated classic, The Grinch. I mean, I have a pretty deep childhood connection with that. And I absolutely love that story. I think it's fantastic. Narrated by Boris Karloff and really, really atmospheric. So I would have to fall down that. So those are some of the two biggies that really come to mind.
And how about, there's a favorite here. My wife insists on watching this film when wrapping presents, and that's another modern classic, and that's Elf. What are your thoughts on Elf?
Oh yes. I would definitely take my hat off to Elf, and Will Ferrell's performance there as Buddy is pretty classic. I grew up on a steady diet of Will Ferrell movies, and like Anchorman movies, Blades of Glory, Talladega Nights, and I think he kind of nails this kind of cringe-worthy, ridiculous sort of characters that he just inhabits. And Buddy is probably in that category, and so I have to admit I'm a big fan of that movie too.
Yeah, it's great to see him wandering through New York in that kind of elf costume, and just the way he interacts. It reminds me of when Crocodile Dundee comes to New York and is wandering around with this wide-eyed innocence of that this place that's a big city and it's dangerous, and you know, you're not meant to approach people and just randomly talk to them and all of these things. But he's got this wonderful open kind of innocence to him, and I love that part of it, him discovering New York and just having seeing it through these fresh eyes. And as you mentioned, Will Ferrell with Anchorman and all those sorts of films, that there's always some amazing quotes and lines that people will use. I always like the cotton-headed Ninny Muggins. Always makes me laugh. When he answers the phone and goes, "Buddy the Elf, what's your favourite colour?" there's some classic lines in there. And actually, when I was watching it recently, there was a scene actually that it stood out and actually made me think of Urgent Care. And sometimes, I've mentioned this in the podcast various times before, sometimes you can just find a bit of CPD based on something completely non-medical. And it occurred when Buddy was making his journey from the North Pole down, presumably through Canada. I'd imagine he took a route through Canada to get to New York. And there's a point where he's happily strolling through the snow-covered little wood, and he comes across a raccoon, and he tries to give the raccoon a hug and make it feel better because it looks a bit angry, and the raccoon jumps and bites him. And animal bites are something we see in urgent care a lot. So it made me wonder, but I've never been, well, I think I've seen a raccoon in a zoo perhaps, but I've never been out there in the wilderness of Canada. So have you come across raccoons in your day-to-day life when you lived in Canada, and do they attack innocent elves who are just walking past?
Well, those are some very good questions to ponder. And yes, not to sound too much like a Canadian stereotype, but yes, I have seen raccoons. I've seen lots of raccoons, actually.
Are they the equivalent of possums in New Zealand? Are they that sort of ubiquitous?
I think I would find them a much, I mean, not to be too kind of judgy, I would find them to be a much superior creature to a possum, personally. Okay. And I'll tell you why. They are interesting animals. So they are true North American native animal. They have been exported to other countries. For example, they now have a range in continental Europe because of being brought over in that area. And they unfortunately turn out to be a little bit of a pest. And by pest, it really means they are a species that actually thrives when they are in proximity to humans. So they are very intelligent. They they actually estimate the intelligence on par with, say, a rhesus macaque, so kind of some of the monkey species. And they are very dexterous. And even though they don't have opposable thumb, they are able to kind of manipulate a lot of things with the digits that they have and can be actually quite capable as a result of their intelligence and this dexterity. So I'm quite fascinated by them as an animal. And I just think they look like kind of really clever, cheeky sort of animals. So I have come across them. It's usually either kind of in a what we call an edge. They are an edge specialist. So basically in that edge between, you know, say forested life or wildlife and human existence, they actually thrive in this kind of environment. And they're often referred to as an edge species. Having said that, I've never known or heard of a raccoon to spontaneously attack, other than ones that are ill. And some of your listeners may know, you myself might know, that raccoons are one of the species that are considered high risk in terms of rabies. They can be carriers of rabies. They can be infected by the disease. So I would be very concerned in the context of an attack that this might be an animal that's actually rabid. They do actually play host to a number of other pathogens as well too, so, you know, leptospirosis, listeriosis, tetanus, tularemia, trichinella even. So there are a number of reasons why you would want to be concerned. I know that particular scene that you're talking about in Elf 2 leaves me medically concerned from another reason, because that raccoon looks like it probably inflicted a wound in probably, I'm guessing, zone 2 of Buddy's neck. So I would be very concerned about some of the structures in the zone 2 of his neck there on the right side.
Yeah, certainly he seems to walk it off okay. We don't see him going to an urgent care to get patched up, but yeah, it does seem to lunge for his neck. And yeah, as he was just trying to make it feel better on his journey from the, what is it, past the candy cane forest through the twirly whirly something or others and past the narwhal and through the Lincoln Tunnel and then into New York. So
it's quite a journey.
Yeah, I mean there's a few medical things in Elf. I mean his diet is probably not your five a day of vegetables. It's your five a day of sugar syrups and candy cane, and he eats chewing gum off the street that he finds on the street. But it was interesting to see a bite like that. And so if I'm in Canada, I don't have to fear a raccoon coming and biting me. But in Christmas in New Zealand, we do see bites from particularly new animals, so pets being given for Christmas, even though a dog or a cat is for life, not just for Christmas. There are a lot given at Christmas, and then kids will go and try and cuddle them and they get a bite. And then there's the consequences then of those animal bites. So why don't we try and just extract a little bit of clinical pearl from this, because we obviously don't have to be too concerned about rabies, as you mentioned with the raccoon, but what should we be concerned about in any animal bite in a kiwi over Christmas?
Well, yeah, and that's a really good question, and I'm going to jump onto that one in a second. But I think, in fairness to the raccoon, before we step off this and broaden our discussion, that they are much more at risk from us than we are from them. And in fact, the top two reasons why raccoons die are hunting or traffic. They get hit by vehicles, and their life expectancy in the wild, which essentially is tantamount to living in this edge I described, is usually 2 to 3 years. Whereas in the purely natural environment, they would probably live up to 20 years. So although there are implications to us, we have to, I think, take a moment to think of the poor raccoons whose territory we invade sometimes. but having said that, as it relates to us, yeah, it is. We tend to forget that, actually. Mm-hmm. For example, I think sharks is a classic example. I mean, we are much more... I'm surprised that music doesn't play when we approach a shark or a fishing boat approaches a shark. But, I live in Nelson, so I have to have at least some kind of environmental message in this podcast.
No, fair enough. So if you are in Canada or you go traveling and you see a raccoon, give it its dues, steer clear of it and let it live a long life.
Just bear in mind that you're in its territory, not the other way around, usually. Right. Oh, but in terms of animal bites, this is a topic I actually find really interesting. And I have seen some over my career, both in Canada and different places. And I do find it very interesting. And it, It is something to consider. They estimate that probably about 1% of ED presentations in most environments can be actually as a result of an animal bite. And the large, and I would suspect without knowing the data that translates probably reasonably well from what I've seen in my experience into urgent care as well. And the most common, as we all know, is dog bites. And we do see a number of cat bites as well too, but dog bites I think still really fills up the quota of what we see in terms of bite. And they are usually children that do get bitten, and it's kind of that age between toddler age and preteen. So that kind of usually 2 till 10 years old is usually the age group that we see. I think when it comes to animal bites, we also have to consider that other people who may be at higher risk. So other patient populations might want to really focus on that, like the immunocompromised or diabetics, other conditions which may lead to poor blood supply. Those who have prosthesis in the area that were bitten or grafting in the area that were bitten. And also, what was the mechanism? Is this a strong crush injury from a very big dog, or is this just a small puncture wound and that penetrated deeply? Are there deeper structures involved? And has the presentation been delayed? Is it greater than 12 hours? That's a real concern for animal bites because of the level of contamination. In the face, we're a little bit more lenient because of that rich blood supply, and we can usually call a facial bite that's greater than 24 hours delayed as a delayed bite. But usually for most other wounds, after 12 hours, you definitely want to be considering that a delayed injury.
And it's a sort of a Christmas thing. Would you say a delayed injury? Because if you've got the family round and you've got a new puppy and it nips you, are you going to leave? You may have had a drink. Are you going to leave to drive to get seen in the urgent care? Or you've got presents to do, you've got this to do. And so the Christmas pressure might mean people do delay and go in on Boxing Day or wherever because of that. So that Christmas may actually lead to people being a little more delayed in their presentation.
Yeah, I think you're quite right there, Guy. And that's something to consider. So you'd really want to kind of get at these wounds early because of that potential to contamination, especially in those high-risk groups that I mentioned. In terms of some of the bugs that you're going to kind of come across, you're going to get the garden variety things like Staph aureus and Strep pyogenes, and those can inhabit that oral flora. But you have to be wary about some of the other ones that are specific to animal bites, like the incidence of Pastorella may be high. What's that? Captophagia.
This is the Ghost of Christmas Future here. Just popping in to make a small clarification that Dinesh wanted adding since he listened back to this recording. The bacteria in question is Capnocytophagia canimorsis.
Which can lead to sepsis as well, Bartonella, those kind of bugs as well too, that you really have to be a little bit concerned about as well too, in terms of getting into the wound. So your history and your examination has to be quite meticulous, I think, with these types of injuries.
And I remember talking with Dave Sorrell about the futility of using IV cephalosporins as part of the out of hospital antibiotic protocols in cat bites, because a lot of the bugs that you've just mentioned really only respond to Augmentin and a few other kind of concoctions, but the IV cefazolin, it's not for that. So if you're considering putting somebody on IV treatment for a dog bite or a cat bite, you're probably speaking to the hospital. And you've mentioned briefly the buddy got bitten towards the neck. Where would you be the most concerned, have the highest index of suspicion in a bite? Where would you be most worried about when someone was bitten?
Yeah. So I think that would be a great example of a potentially vulnerable area where a deep puncture might be extremely concerning. With Buddy there, but it sounds like he had a superficial injury. So that, then again, your kind of your history and your examination will kind of help guide you on that. I think some of the areas that you really have to pay special attention to are those areas like the face, those that are in proximity to tendon and joint, and those that might lead to some kind of neurovascular compromise or have some kind of significant vessel or nerve supply lying in proximity. So those are the areas that you're really going to want to examine very carefully. Obviously, your primary concern, like any wound, is actually hemostasis. So if that person is actively bleeding, you're going to manage that aggressively, but you're going to be quite prompt as well too about making a deeper assessment and an appropriate referral if required.
And what about irrigation as a means of cleaning bite wounds? Do people do that adequately enough, do you find in your experience, or do we tend to not do it enough?
In my experience, we tend to do quite a cursory irrigation of wounds. Yeah. And I think we could be a little bit more aggressive in this regard. Remember, it has to do with the kind of mechanical effect of irrigation. That's why we irrigate. So you want to have a little bit of gentle pressure actually associated with that irrigation. I remember a mentor of mine who was a Texan surgeon, and he would always go around with his drawl saying the solution to pollution is dilution. And that's always stuck with me. But I would add that it's dilution with pressure. So make sure that it's the pressure irrigation. And usually the pressure that you can obtain, which would be adequate, would be something like taking a 50cc syringe and putting basically a 12-gauge.
The Ghost of Christmas Future again. Another small clarification from Dinesh. A 50cc syringe with a 16 to 18 gauge cannula with the sharp removed is the best for irrigation.
Maybe a cannula where you've extracted the sharp and that sort of and put a kind of a firm even pressure on it should achieve the kind of the PSI that you require for irrigation, and then use copious volume actually to clear. And so what you're looking to do is actually to clear out some of that dirt, the actual physical debris that's in the wound, and remember that can be done in combination with debridement of the wound to take away some of that devitalized tissue, which could become problematic as well. I think once you move from irrigation in terms of a decision around kind of closure and antibiotics, there are some things to consider there. I don't think we should really be looking to close kind of significant crushed areas or deep punctures or wounds on the hand and feet, in particular maybe cat bites as well too. You might not want to close those. They tend to be very deep and they tend towards infection, so you want that area to drain. And also consider what is your kind of venous supply and your lymphatic drainage in the patient. If those are poor, you probably don't want to be closing those wounds. And that's really because we're looking out for some of these downstream effects, which is maybe a subcutaneous abscess or osteomyelitis or potential septiarthritis. And so closuring of these wounds may actually cause a problem then now lying under the skin, which remains undetected. You touched on antibiotics as well, Guy. And that's, I think, worth mentioning as well, that it doesn't have to be automatic in all cases. I think in all cat bites, it should be done. And probably all dog bites that involve the face, hands, feet, or genitals, so any kind of sensitive area with dog bites, I think those should be de facto antibiotics. But very kind of superficial wounds and well-vascularized areas, if you do a very good kind of wound management, it's probably reasonable to defer the antibiotic therapy with these patients. And again, augmented is going to be your first line. Consider areas that may require surgical management. They should probably go on to antibiotics right away while they're awaiting their definitive treatment. So for example, if they develop an abscess, et cetera, or those in proximity, as we mentioned, bones, joints, nerves, et cetera, that'll probably be referred on. And I think the last kind of categories as well too that you want to probably start antibiotics on are those that are going to be immunocompromised or at risk of a poor immune support response around that bite, and those with maybe prostheses as well too, like heart valves or prostheses around joints as well too. You probably want to be a little more aggressive with their therapy as well too. So those are kind of the general guidelines that I follow, and I'm sure we can put some references in the show notes as well too for people to read up a little bit more around those.
And there's a good nice guideline I think now that has a table that lets you decide when to give antibiotics that kind of summarizes what you said. I'll see if I can find a link to that if you haven't got one. And I think one thing I would add is that it's always worth, if you're not sure, speaking to the plastic surgeon or whoever manages the wounds in your local hospital if you're in doubt. And particularly over the phone, nowadays you can send pictures and other kind of means of sharing information and getting their input if you're in doubt, because it is important to get it right on day one. And the other thing is following up often over Christmas if general practices are closed. We're the only place that patients can come back, so they should come back to have a wound review to make sure that it's healing, addressing change, and make sure infection hasn't set in. So a good tight follow-up over the holiday period when they've got no one else to go to should be arranged. Anything else you'd add to that?
I agree with that, Guy. That's really excellent thinking on that. The last thing we'd want to see is an elf that's, you know, taken out of action as a result of a bite that's been poorly managed. Mm. I think nobody in our audience would really want that on their conscience, personally.
No. Although, what would you say if Will Ferrell walked in, having been bitten by a raccoon, dressed in an elf costume to an urgent care on a... It would be... I would enjoy that.
Well, I think I would probably match his level of excitement, really. So that would really be a great, that would be really one of the best Christmases ever, really.
It would be a good present, wouldn't it? And I think that would be my advice to anybody who hasn't seen Elf would be to look it up on a streaming platform or get the DVD somehow and watch it at Christmas. It's a very lovely Christmas film and worth watching. And when you get to the raccoon bite scene, you can mark it down as CPD that you've listened to this. And thanks to Dinesh, we now know a little bit more about raccoons, how we should respect them in their environment, how that they are unlikely to bite you unless you go out of your way to annoy them. And we should try and live a little more harmoniously with raccoons going forwards. But if we do see a bite of any kind, it's the same approach as outlined by Dinesh there. And the links will be in the show notes. So I hope you have a happy, safe and enjoyable Christmas and New Year period, Dinesh. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Guy. Same to you. And look forward to catching up with you in the New Year.
Yep. See you in 2022.